Today, an interview with two of the voices in the forefront of advocating for abuse survivors.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Recently, three entities of the Southern Baptist Convention, the largest non-Catholic denomination in the country, stunned a lot of people by filing a document with a court in Kentucky which argues to make it more difficult for sex abuse victims and survivors to hold their abusers and the institutions that protect those abusers accountable for their harms. I was equally shocked, dumbfounded. So I had to process in my own terms why denominational leaders, why religious leaders would make such a bad decision. And then I was hoping to have someone on who could clarify the issues about this actual situation for us. That's what led to this interview. All right, so it's a real privilege for me to be joined by two survivors and advocates who are making a real difference in this area. And I'm just flabbergasted that they've both taken time to spend with me talking about it today. And I think it's going to make a real difference in how you think about the issue if you can hear from them directly what they think about all of this that we're talking about. So first, I'm joined by Rachel Den Hollander. She is a leading voice regarding sexual abuse, survivor advocacy all around the country. You most probably know her first as a gymnast and then as the person who finally shined a light on the abuses of Larry Nassar, the USA Gymnastics doctor and Michigan State doctor. And Michigan State, man, is still facing major consequences because of this. And then now she's an attorney who confronts sexual abusers and the institutions that protect them and is an advocate on behalf of survivors. And Rachel, I didn't find that bio anywhere. I just, you know, that's how I think of you. So please feel free to correct that. But thank you so much for joining us.
It's an absolute privilege to be here. I appreciate you having the conversation.
Yeah. And I think it's fair to say, I mean, your goal is to call out sexual abusers and institutions that protect them, and then to advocate on behalf of survivors. Does that cover it fairly?
Yeah, absolutely. And especially within the Christian framework, to ask the question, how does our theology inform our understanding of abuse? How does it inform our understanding of justice and repentance and all of these threshold issues? You know, if we're going to claim the name of Christ and we're going to say that he is Lord over all, and that we bow our knee to him, well, what does that mean for us in practicality when it comes to these types of issues?
Yeah, amen to that. And by the way, I really appreciate some of the stuff you did with Russell Moore back in the day. And even more recently, now that he's at Christianity Today, he, right now, you have to be thinking to yourself, wow, he kind of smells like a rose right now, having gotten out of this mess beforehand. Anyway, that said, the other person joining me is Tiffany Thigpen. And Tiffany is a survivor of abuse as a young person in church and now an advocate of survivors, all survivors of abuse, but particularly those who experience that abuse in the environment where they should have been the safest, which is in their own church. And Tiffany, I've met you personally. And again, I'm making up that bio. That's how I know you. Is that a fair statement for who you are?
It is a fair statement. And thank you so much for allowing me to have a voice in this.
Yeah, well, my privilege, Tiffany. And again, our personal meeting really convinced me not only of the sincerity and the energy and the wisdom that you bring to the battle that you're fighting, but also the reality of your Christianity. Because, you know, our institution, Criswell College, we made a formal apology for some of the things that we just didn't do enough back in the 90s when we could have protected people by holding some of our graduates or just former students more accountable. And you were extremely gracious and kind about allowing us to share that, and then also in just in your response to it. So first of all, just a word of appreciation to you for making that something that allowed people to see that we can say we're sorry and move from there. So I don't know what your thoughts were on all of that, but it was really great to get to know you through that.
It is a very healthy stance to take, to be able to take accountability for things that you were not even a part of or privy to, things that did not even happen on your watch, but at your institution and within, based on previous leadership. And I greatly appreciated your, not only your heart in wanting to do that, but also the vulnerability in doing that, because obviously you are taking a hit for something that others made choices for. And I think the SBC as a whole tries to cover itself and not make those apologies, being that it happened on other people's watch. It's kind of an attitude of, well, it's not happening now, or it didn't happen while I was on watch. But that's not the stance that we should take, because we all represent Christ and we all are supposed to be working together in this and loving each other, protecting each other, and doing what's right.
Yeah, you
so
would
I
think.
Really appreciated it.
And by the way, just to put this in perspective, you know, you were kind enough to say, well, I'm taking a hit because we're, you know, willing to take. Even that concept, which you're very sincere and very kind for saying, even that concept, any pushback I got from people who wished I hadn't said that, and any shame I feel for what happened in the history, you know, of our institution and our denomination, is nothing compared with what you, so many different people, have gone through. It's just not even on the same level, and I cannot comprehend why we're not measuring that correctly. So anyway, before I go further with that, I just want to mention this statement, Tiffany. There was a statement that was released by you and Megan Lively and Jules Woodson, some other survivors of abuses in the Southern Baptist Convention and entities of different kinds. And part of your statement was this, to make clear how strong this issue is to you. There is no mincing of words here. This is what y'all said. There's no mincing of words here, no holding back. This is disgusting. Now, that's a pretty strong statement. And I understand where it's coming from, because as I mentioned when we were conversing a moment ago before we started the recording, you've survived the abuse you faced as a young person, only to face one traumatizing barrier after another. In advocating not only for the accountability of your own abuser, which has been a challenge, but on behalf of others who've been abused as well. And those traumas, I can't imagine that they wouldn't re-traumatize you in some way when suddenly there's a brick wall that says, we're not going to hold this person accountable, or we don't want to hear your voice. And it seems like you've run into that a lot. Is that a fair description?
Very fair. And it's not a brick wall. It's so many brick walls, layer upon layer upon layer of them. You know, every time as survivors that we see posts by leadership, even on, you know, social media, Twitter, those kinds of forums, or we sit in EC meetings and listen to some of the comments made, or we make ourselves available for the convention and we hear the comments and things being said about the work that we're doing against us from people who are supposedly representing Christ, it's layer upon layer upon layer of abuses that we have to sit through. We have to hear people say, well, there's not that many cases. The report showed that it's really not that big of a thing. We have to hear people walk up to the microphone at convention dismissing and discounting what's happened to us while we're still actively facing those brick walls. And at times I've described it feels like you're swimming upstream, but even more, it feels like you have just been dropped in the middle of the ocean and you're just fighting to tread water. You're just trying to keep your head above water enough so that you can have your voice heard in some way, hoping every time that this will be the time something changes.
Yeah.
So yes, it's a constant barrier to any sort of justice.
resistance that you faced, and it's you and other survivors as well.
Sure.
But the resistance that y'all have faced from the Southern Baptist Convention entities. And by the way, we did a whole episode on this with Jared Wellman, who I think you would consider an ally,
yes.
talking about. And that whole episode, I mean, my title for the episode was, "What do you do with power? You know, how are we supposed to use the power that we have?" And it's to advocate for those who don't have that power. And it's just absurd that we wouldn't use it for that. The resistance that you received from the SBC consistently, being shut down and told not to, and your case is just ignored entirely, prompted a whole host of denominational responses, including a resolution that was apologizing and all of those kinds of things. So you see hopes like that in moments. And just like you said, you think to yourself, oh, this will be the change. You know, maybe this will bring it to pass. And then these weird things happen where you realize the walls are still up. And yet you're still here. I mean, even having this conversation today, here you are. I'm assuming because you're hoping somebody will hear and that someone will do the right thing. I'm assuming you haven't given up hope.
Hope is getting smaller and smaller.
I hear you.
And we do have those conversations, you know, when do you walk away? When do you give up?
Right. I understand that.
So many of us, and there have been some that have given up and they had to for their own sanity and self-preservation, or some that are still watching, but they just don't have it in them to be vocal anymore.
Yeah.
And I certainly understand all sides of it. For me, I mentioned to someone this morning that I wish that I didn't know what I know, because if I didn't know what's happening and how many more survivors there are to come, other victims that are going to face these same, you know, horrible deeds done against us and face the same resistances. If I didn't have that knowledge, I could walk away with a clean conscience. But because I know that others are going to face what we have faced, it makes it so hard to walk away, because it feels as if you're abandoning others to come.
Yeah. You know,
go ahead. I can't even say hope anymore. It's more of
obligation.
You have to live. Yeah, obligation. You have to live with this.
Yeah. So, Rachel, I'm going to come to you because I'm not on top of this as aware of all of these things as y'all are. And I noticed in social media a week ago or so, people that I follow, because I want to hear how their cases are moving forward or who is hearing them or who's resisting them now. And I saw some of those voices saying, that's it, I'm done, I quit, I'm not going to do this anymore. And I had no idea what was going on. So I started looking things up, Rachel, and as I did, I found this case in Kentucky in an amicus brief, and what on earth has happened? So as I have found out, I've read a couple of articles and figured out kind of what's going on, but you're an attorney, so I'm assuming you pay attention to things like this all the time, and on this one, you know the details. And I'm not asking you to give us everything, but Rachel, if you wouldn't mind, can you kind of catch us up, like, just on the background? This is why I'm having this conversation today, because of this case that came up in Kentucky. If you could tell us a little about that, and then I have a question to follow up from it. Can you tell us about the Kentucky case that sort of originated this whole tempest?
Yeah, absolutely. So the victim in this case is a young woman named Samantha Killery. She was adopted by a Louisville County police officer. And that police officer, who was her adopted father, began raping her at the age of about 4 years old and continued raping her for the majority of her childhood. And he confessed on audio tape several years ago, and he is in jail for the rest of his life. But the question is, who helps bear responsibility for that, right? And so this lawsuit brings forward some allegations against the police department specifically, that there were multiple officers within that department who knew her father and who knew Samantha was being abused, and who themselves, as police officers, broke mandatory reporting laws, which allowed Samantha to continue being abused. Now, Samantha had brought this lawsuit several years ago, but because of a very short statute of limitations, the law did not allow that question to be considered, right? Samantha was not allowed to get into the court system to ask the question, does the police department bear responsibility in part for my abuse because there were officers who knew it was happening and broke the law by not reporting? And so this lawsuit is seeking to answer that question. And the controversy right now is whether or not a legal change to the statute of limitations applies to third-party entities. These are called non-offending third parties, right? A non-offending third party isn't somebody who's done nothing wrong. It means that it's not the person who committed the actual crime, right? So in the case of Catholic church abuse, for example, the priest who raped the child is the offending party. The Catholic church who knew he was raping kids and kept moving him around parish to parish is the non-offending third party. In Samantha's lawsuit, her father is the perpetrator, and the police department, whose officers allegedly knew about it and did not report, is the non-offending third party. And the question is whether or not non-offending third parties who perhaps broke the law by not reporting, covered up abuse, facilitated, enabled abuse, whether those non-offending third parties should be partly responsible for the abuse that was suffered and help cover the cost of the damages.
Now, it's automatic to me to understand why that would suddenly resonate with entities in the Southern Baptist Convention who are being confronted with their shared responsibility for what continued to happen with abuses in organizations that they were associated with. I get that, but there's a legal a side of this question that I don't understand, Rachel, and you don't have to answer this, so I'm just curious. I mean, as an attorney, would you just have been aware of what was going on in this Kentucky case? Was this something being circulated? Everybody's better start paying attention to this. I mean, how did the SBC lawyers even know this was happening in Kentucky, or was it just in the news? Was it a big deal up there?
So the way that they know is because it is relevant to potential litigation against the SBC, right? Because there's this is what's stated in their amicus brief, that there are a number of lawsuits that have been filed in Kentucky that have made similar allegations that there were SBC entities that knew of abuse and either didn't report it or negligently failed to prevent it. And so it's relevant to the argument that's being made in specific cases that are in Kentucky in the SBC.
So here we are as a convention that says we want to advocate on behalf of survivors and we want to stop being resistant. And we pass a resolution that apologizes and says we're going to do everything we can to make a difference. And in this case, I'm saying the SBC, I had nothing to do with it, hopefully. Well, I did because I'm part of the SBC, so I carry some of that. But, we file this brief, this amicus brief, and if you could tell us what that was about and what the brief was doing, I think that would be helpful, too.
Yeah, absolutely. So just a few years ago, there was a change to Kentucky law that extended the statute of limitations. The statute of limitations gives a specific time frame in which legal action can be brought. It extended the statute of limitations, and then it also opened what we call a window to justice. And this is something that states across our country have been doing. This is not a new theory. It's not novel. It's not unique. The constitutionality of retroactive statute of limitations reform, not just in sexual abuse cases, but in certain tax code provisions and in other civil litigation, has been tested over and over, and it has been consistently upheld. So this is not a novel or a new idea that Kentucky did. But Kentucky opened a window to justice, which says that, hey, if you suffered from our formerly unjust statute of limitations, if you were not able to pursue justice because we had bad law on the books, then you have a limited time frame that you can bring that suit now because you couldn't do it before under our old and broken system. So that's what a window to justice is. Uh-huh. And the argument that's being made by the police department in Samantha's case is that window to justice should not apply to entities. It should only apply to individuals. So if you were to think of it like a case that everyone's familiar with, the Larry Nassar case, we should be able to sue Larry. We should not be able to hold Michigan State University responsible for allowing Larry to abuse so many girls after knowing he was committing abuse in 1997. Right. So the SBC looked at that and essentially said, OK, that's relevant to us because we have some entities that are currently being sued for allegedly covering up abuse. Now, an important thing to know about the statute of limitations and statute of limitations reform is that it doesn't actually change the rules regarding responsibility, right? So it doesn't change the burden of proof. The victim still bears the burden of proving that all of these legal elements are met. It doesn't change credibility assessments. It doesn't change our evidentiary code. And it doesn't change the reality that no one can be held accountable in a court of law unless you first show that they had a duty to the person, that they breached that duty, and that because they breached that duty, the harm that they should have foreseen or knew was going to happen actually did happen. Samantha still has to prove all of that. Mm-hmm. Any survivor of SBC abuse still has to prove all of that. None of that has changed with statute of limitations reform. The only thing that statute of limitations reform and windows to justice create is access to the justice system. It's the difference between saying, hey, we didn't do anything wrong, and hey, you're not allowed to ask that question. So the SBC looked at this window to justice and they looked at Samantha's case and they said, well, that's relevant to us because we have entities that are being sued for allegedly covering up abuse. And so and the situation is that Samantha's case is the first case to test that statute. And so the reality is that any determination that is made in Samantha's case is going to impact the SBC. And so the SBC decided to voluntarily and proactively file a brief supporting the police department's arguments that entities should not be able to be applied under this window to justice. An amicus brief is a voluntary and proactive brief that is filed in support of one party or the other. Yeah. And the SBC chose to file it in support of the police department, against arguing that those who enabled abuse should not be held responsible under the statute of limitations.
Wow. So to be clear, all this does is give an opportunity, if I hear you correctly, it just gives an opportunity for the survivor's claim to be heard.
And that's correct. The only thing it does is give citizens access to the justice system. That's it.
You know, I think it's parallel, and I'm just going to insert this real quickly, because some people just don't get the difference between those two things. And so I think it's parallel to this. You know, I've said women's voices were suppressed for so long, and really it's millennia, but for so long, even in our legal system, that now when there is an outcry, when there is some claim, we should give special privilege to that claim. That doesn't mean we assume guilt on the part of the accused, but it does mean we have to give room for that voice to be heard. You understand what I'm saying? And I'm just saying that in general, not about the law, just about what every person should be doing. You know, I've got to give space for any accusation to be heard and thoroughly weighed out. And this doesn't seem to do any more than that. If we had bad laws in place, then it makes sense that we should give victims or survivors now who've gotten past that the opportunity to go back and say, this is what happened to me and somebody should make this right. And that's all that's happening here. I mean, that's the goal, isn't it, in Kentucky?
Yep, that's absolutely correct. This reform does absolutely nothing other than give survivors mere access to the justice system.
Okay, so I just, you know, this isn't actually about the SBC, and I get that you say, well, they have an interest because this law affects them, but why on earth insert yourself into something that's against a survivor trying to speak out about abuse and is just covering yourself, you know, protecting yourself? What would motivate? I mean, it seems like somebody would have said to them, don't do this. Rachel, I'm just curious from the legal side, if you have any thoughts about that. I mean, it just seems like a terrible thing to have done.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are kind of probably two layers to this. You know, obviously, quite obviously, I was not in the room for those discussions. But there are a couple of things that typically motivate this. One of which is if they can get the court to rule in the police department's favor, well, then just across the board, that helps protect their entities that may have covered up and facilitated abuse, right? And then the next issue is that most of the time with insurance policies, we have something called a cooperation clause. And a cooperation clause is basically where the insurance company says to the party that they insure, hey, if you don't cooperate fully in defending against litigation, we don't have to pay out on your policy. Right. And so oftentimes that's held up kind of as a boogeyman. Hey, if we don't make absolutely every argument we can possibly make in absolutely every context we can possibly make it, then we might lose our insurance proceeds. But the reality is that it's a lot more nuanced than that, because in order for an insurance company to not be able to pay out under the cooperation clause, you have to be able to show that the failure materially damaged their ability to defend. And the reality with amicus briefs is that that's not typically the case. right? Because the same arguments were already made by the police department. If the court was going to buy those arguments, they're going to do it, whether or not the amicus brief is filed. The actual impact from an insurance perspective on an amicus brief is probably very low, right? That's at least something that ought to be discussed, whether or not the SBC even derived any real benefit from this brief if they were interested in the institutional protectionism portion of it at all. So there's that threshold. But then there's also the next question of just what are the goals of our institution? What is in the best interest of our institution? Right, because that's another discussion point that attorneys often raise, is the aspect of being a fiduciary. And a fiduciary means that you have to act in the best interest of your institution. And again, that's often presented very myopically. The best interest of our institution is to protect our funds. It's to protect our reputation. Rather than having discussion about what are the goals and visions of our institution, what is our ethical code? How does that impact the decisions that we make? Right? Oftentimes, the legal counsel is very myopic. It's very one-sided. It lacks the real nuance that is actually present in the legal arguments. And then, of course, once you get past all of that, you have the overarching and fundamental moral question that ought to be driving everything, which is the, okay, I can, but should I?
Yeah.
And that's where the rubber really hits the road, even more for the SBC, is the should I question. But the can I question is much, much more nuanced than that is often presented in these situations.
Yeah, and I want to come back to you on that particular issue. Tiffany, I want to ask you just from your perspective, now that we kind of have a little of the background, so you have, you know, a survivor who's trying to make a claim, and then you have this brief that drops from the SBC, from three entities in the SBC saying, she shouldn't be able to speak. Don't give her this opportunity, because that would mean other survivors are going to be able to speak to us. And I don't know how you found out about it, Tiffany, but I'm curious how it struck you in the moment you did find out, and, you know, where it has gone since then for you.
Yes. Well, the immediate reaction to finding out about it, of course, is wanting to get more information. You know, everyone has a take on what was done. I wanted to see it for myself. I wanted to read it. I wanted to know who was involved. And I'm sure anyone following saw that I was just hammering social media, drilling down for answers and trying to find out who was involved before I let go of my wrath. Because that's probably the best way to describe what I was feeling, was just absolute wrath. I was ready to join in with the burn it down movement of just, this whole thing needs to crumble. This is, you know, this is institutional betrayal again, once again. But I did want to know who the players were. I wanted to know who was making the decisions, because it's our own risk assessment. As survivors, we're constantly battling whom we can trust and who we cannot, and who is safe and who is not, and constantly negotiating those things in our minds, and even at times unable to make those decisions just because of the lack of trust and the loss of safety that we've had in our lives. So I needed to know, you know, which EC players were involved, as far as the ones that are for us, did they also take part in this? The ones that are against us, I wanted to know which ones were a part of it. You know, just trying to get my brain around the whole thing.
And when you say EC, I'm just going to clarify, this is the Executive Committee of the Southern Baptist Convention, and you all have been dealing with them for years.
Correct.
So, yeah, go ahead.
And some a little closer than others. Some have earned a little more trust in our world than others. And so, of course, I turned to those first, and the immediate responses from every single person I was reaching out to was, I did not know. I had no idea. And that was the theme, you know, I'll get back to, I'm trying to find out myself, continued to play out, including even top leadership that probably should have known, was learning for the first time. Rachel herself was learning for the first time, had discussions with Rachel right off the bat, trying to understand. And I was so confused, didn't even know the amicus brief existed. Rachel had to like point me in the right direction to show me you know, kind of more about what it's about. And she was trying to get answers herself. So shock, anger, fear kicked in. You know, have we been betrayed all along? Do we now really look like fools for ever having trusted them and tried to give everyone else hope all this time? So that's where the statement came from. We began to form it. Jules, Megan, and I tried to state what we were feeling in the moment, what we wanted out of the situation. We wanted answers, and we wanted people to explain to us why monies are being spent on counteractive defense moves for everything that the SBC had promised. Yeah. And, you know, in that statement is included the point, I went back and started reading all the resolutions because I just started thinking, you know, they resolved that they were going to help us against statute of limitations, criminal and civil, that they were going to help us to make sure that there was no, I mean, it says in the statute of limitations, criminal and civil, that they do not unduly protect perpetrators of sexual abuse and individuals who enabled them. Yet, they file an amicus brief that does that very thing, that goes against survivors and for perpetrators. And the reason I say that is because if it's not given a voice, if we're not able to bear witness in a court of law to give our proof and our testimony, the chances of ever getting to a court of law for a survivor are very, very slim, very slim. To get to prosecution, to be heard, to get past filing a report is monumental for most survivors. And most of those don't go anywhere. So now you're telling us that we can get all the way to a court case, but we can only tell what happened in this time period and no other. So you're going to limit our own testimony and our story. That's already a hard burden to bear in our justice system anywhere. And to find out that the very state, Kentucky, where so many of our survivor cases, you know, we have Jen Lyle, we have Hannah Kate, we have Samantha's case, of course, we have so many other survivors that might not even be publicly known yet, but that are certainly known within the reporting databases and in discovery that came out of the Houston Chronicle's report. You are going to file against us in Kentucky, Southern Seminary, Lifeway Christian Resources. Now the executive committee and the SBC as a whole are going to join and sign off on that. It is disgusting.
I'm, you know, if I'm most hopeful of anything in this episode, it's not hopeful is not the right term here. If I were looking for some way that I could comprehend how on earth this happened, I would be wishing that it were some rogue individuals who had made this decision and had snuck it through against the will of the majority of people in the EC, the executive committee, or against the actual administration of Lifeway or the actual leadership of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. And I read your social media post, Tiffany, and so I'm just asking your opinion here. I'm not pretending that you work inside of any of those entities or have that scoop. But I am curious if it's your impression. Are these things that reflect the nature of those institutions, or are these rogue individuals inside those institutions who are sneaking out this kind of resistance, or, you know, trying to buckle against the efforts that are being made for reform? Do you have an opinion on that you're willing to share?
I would say it's a little bit of both. That's what I've seen. And of course this is opinion, but it's also based on some facts. That's what I've seen in the decades that I've been working in this. There's always a little bit of both. Yeah. It's impossible for us to get out all of the bad apples out of an organization or an institution. We all know this.
Right.
Look at the changes that we've made in the last few years within the decision makers, within the executive committee, within presidential leadership, within all levels of the you know, structure of the SBC as a whole, I feel like the messengers and the people have started to see some of the corrupt voices that have been being listened to in decisions that go back with the previous law firms and for years against survivors, and holding lists of names of survivors that they were doing nothing with and denying that there was a problem. So it is all about who we're listening to. Who are the voices that have the most volume with leadership? We all know that the attorneys are going to do their job. We know that they are hired to protect the institution. We hope that within that, that some of the people making those decisions are also asking questions and pushing back with the attorneys as to what morally and ethically and soundly the choice needs to make, despite whatever the legal offerings are.
Yeah, just what Rachel was talking about, you know, that
exactly.
There's more to our values than money.
We hope.
we hope, but where's the evidence? Where's the fruit that says that's true right now? Yeah, exactly. Listen,
yeah, we've been told.
Go ahead, Tiffany.
I'm sorry. We've been told for years, and especially in the last, I'd say 4 or 5 years, we've been told over and over, you know, survivors, we're listening. Survivors, we have a heart for you. We have a heart to make sure that our churches are the safest places that they can be. We're going to do everything in our power to make that so. But what's shown continues to be completely different. It's like we are being gaslit constantly.
See, if I could come back to you, Rachel, I would say this. And by the way, I'll say this to both of you. I can kind of understand just basically what you were saying. I can understand legally that people could make arguments for why it needs to, you know, there needs to be a statute of limitations and you can only complain back this far or whatever. I don't agree with it, but I can understand that somebody might do that because I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a legislator. I don't do any of that stuff. And so people over there can haggle all that out. I don't understand at all why a person as a Christian who's supposed to be an advocate for the voiceless, who's supposed to use their power on behalf of those who don't have power in a certain situation, I don't understand at all what would motivate us as Christians to say, no, we really don't want your voice heard at this point. I just don't understand it. There's no reason for either of you to respond to that. I just don't get it. I don't understand how any Christian can think that they're somehow representing the Spirit of Christ and doing that to survivors. Okay, that said, that was my diatribe. I'm done. Rachel, I'd love to ask you a question, and then Tiffany, I'm going to ask you basically the same question, but in your context instead of the law. Okay. Rachel, my question for you is this, and you can go as far afield as you want. This is the last major question I wanted to ask. As you look at this amicus brief, and you said it's probably not that big a deal in terms of its actual effect legally because it's just coming alongside claims that were already made, arguments that were already made, and so on. I get all that. The damage was all, you know, in standing against survivors when we're saying we've passed all these resolutions and so on. So I understand that. But legally, it does represent something. And you, as an attorney, looking at the Southern Baptist Convention and dealing with, beyond the Southern Baptist Convention, dealing with all kinds of organizations who are covering themselves in these moments. If you wanted to say to the other leaders in the convention who want to undo this, who want to make it right, if you said, well, if you really want to undo some of this damage, here's what you should do. Would you have any advice to give, or would you say, yeah, too late, you've burned your bridges, you're done? If somebody said they wanted to make it right, any advice?
Well, it's never too late to start doing the right thing, right? It didn't take us so long to do the right thing, but it's never too late. There's extensive debate on whether or not they can actually withdraw the brief at that point in time. Time and resources ought to be put into answering that question to see if it's something that they can do. And if it is, then in my opinion, they should, right? But beyond that, to take concrete action steps to begin restoring the halls of justice to survivors. You know, there are numerous states. My home state of Michigan actually is considering a statute of limitations window to justice just today. There are a number of states that are engaged in that. The Southern Baptist Convention could be a leader in those efforts, as they have been in some other legislative efforts, actually, at saying, you know what, we're going to stand on the side of the vulnerable. We're going to stand on the side of what is right. We are going to lend our voice and our platform towards doing justice. And there actually are a few areas where SBC leaders have done that. There are a number of state convention leaders that have been very active in legislative efforts to criminalize clergy parishioner sexual conduct, to make sure that kind of conduct can actually be caught and can be prosecuted. And that's been really encouraging to see. The convention has the opportunity to do the same thing here, because the reality is that statute of limitations reform is one of the greatest tools that we have in reforming institutions and in actually catching active abusers. Because out of every 300 rapes reported to the police on a given year, between 5 and 9 are going to result in criminal conviction and jail time.
Oh, my soul.
Sometimes, yeah. Now, sometimes we get some outlying numbers as high as 25, but on average, it's around 5 to 9. So on the best of years, out of every 300 rapists reported to the police, 275 of them are going to walk free. Okay. In addition to that, most of what goes wrong in abusers who have a lot of access to victims really happens at the institutional level, right? You have the Catholic Church knowing that there are priests abusing and then covering it up and moving priests around. You have Michigan State University hearing report after report about Larry and burying those reports. You have the Penn State scandal. You can look just across the board. There are structures and systems and frameworks that are often breaking the law in violating mandatory reporting laws, which is part of Samantha's allegations, that didn't have proper policy, that didn't have proper structure, proper training, that hid or covered up reports of abuse, allowing abusers to have access to so many victims for so long. And absent a way to hold those institutions accountable, there is no motivation for those institutions to change. The vast majority of reform that has come with abusive institutions that has actually been effective at protecting the next generation has come because of the reality that, hey, if we don't do this right, we actually might have to pay for it. And so, you know, while the SBC's amicus brief may not have much actual legal impact, meaning they didn't get a lot of benefit from everything, from the great cost that came with it, the reality is that it's a policy position, right? And it is a choice to stand alongside every single abusive institution in this state. It is a choice to stand against every single survivor in this state, in the hopes that maybe it will protect them in a few cases coming down the pipe.
Unbelievable.
That's a significant moral position to take.
So I hear you saying taking concrete steps to restore the halls of justice to survivors. I think that's one of the phrases that you used. I'll paint one picture. I mean, if at the convention, which is 8 months away, if a bunch of messengers, just one after another, say, we move that the convention instruct all of its administrators, everybody, to get on board and take these concrete steps, you know, represent a different policy to these states where these issues are being heard and so on, at least it would be something to sort of force the hand of the denomination to move a different direction. There may be 20 other ways. I don't know how you do that. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, no, not a bit. It would be. And I think another critical part of that is continuing to get voices in the room that are going to bring out the nuance of all of this, that are going to help raise these moral questions to the forefront,
yeah.
Right? And relying on subject matter experts is not something that has always been done well in the SBC. We can see this coming out in the report that was done of the executive committee, where you had a number of individuals who are saying, hey, actually, there are some steps we can take here. And there was just no willingness to engage with those individuals. And so I think on a number of levels, there are absolutely some concrete things that can and should be done.
Good. Thank you for that, Rachel. And then, Tiffany, I kind of want to turn the question to you in the same way, but not about the law, although you're welcome to comment on the legal side of it. You're welcome to comment on any of it. But I'm curious, in you looking at it as a survivor who works so much with people in this denomination and in other church settings and outside of church settings, is there any way in your mind, the SBC, and I'm sure you'd agree with everything Rachel said, is there anything else you would add to what they could do if they actually not just wanted to apologize, but actually wanted to try to undo some of the damage that they've done?
I'll speak more to what the people can do, what the messengers can do, what members within leadership can do, because I think that's a key point, is we are still trying to get vast majorities of people that are the lay people within the churches, but they're also the decision makers that are, you know, the ones that come to convention to vote sometimes, but they might not be involved in what all is going on at the higher levels. And even in some of these choices, I don't feel everyone is quite yet educated. Even our Caring Well Sunday, you know, made it to the calendar this year, but there was hardly any activity on that in individual churches. People still are not aware, I don't believe, of the critical damage that's done to us. I think there's more understanding needed in that so that people are moved to act. You know, God calls people to action when it comes to justice. He does not instruct us biblically to sit by passively, stay out of it, protect the institution while other people are being hurt and abused. Rachel spoke to you about the numbers, the tragic truth of the justice system for survivors. I heard your reaction to it, Dr. Creamer, and, you know, the gasp, because that's a key factor that most people just don't understand. Our ability to get justice, to seek justice, is so minuscule. We don't really stand a chance without an army behind us, making sure that we stay healthy in the process, that we our mental health, our physical health, our strength is available to step forward with the task. But when we do, to know that we have the institution that has betrayed us against us, why would anyone come forward knowing what you're up against? And the numbers that Rachel mentioned that walk free, you know, estimating 275 out of those, they walk free, not whole or healed. They walk free to continue abusing, to do it again and again and again. And when they're moved around in our churches, that's exactly what happens. If you pay any attention at all to social media and to some of the stories that we're constantly putting out as they rise in a media forum that we can put out, that, you know, in which it's saying that this youth pastor was moved from four churches and his the numbers, they're thinking, you know, 25 teenagers. They're thinking that at this church it was 10. They're thinking that the next one, there could be up to 200 based on, you know, where he moved and he worked in camps and he did this and that. The abusers continue to abuse. The numbers are staggering. So by the time a survivor actually comes forward, there's so many factors. Age at the time of the abuse. If they were a small child, obviously they don't have the resources to go and report. Or maybe they do tell a parent or a loved one or a trusted member, and it doesn't go further than that. And it might take until they're, you know, over the age of 18 and they actually find some agency and they start realizing the effects of it on their life and they want to get it, you know, out and told so they can heal and recover. Many factors keep a survivor from going forward. But one of the main factors is once they do, let's say 10 years has passed since the abuse, and once they do, it might take many telling moments before they're believed and heard. So yeah, that's a key point. When they do come forward, if they're bullied, if they aren't believed, if they're silent, shamed, if they feel like somehow they're going to be abandoned if they carry this forward, they go to the police to file a report, and the police isn't even, you know, aren't even sure if they can right. form a case on it based on evidence or based on, you know, testimony of others that might not be willing to come forward with them. And more years can pass, and then they finally find a window to justice, such as what has just opened in Kentucky. And they say, you know what, I'm going to try this again, like Samantha Killery did. She goes to hold her people accountable, the people in her life that failed her, that should have stood up for her, that should have protected her. All these years are past, and they tell her that you had 5 years once you turned 18, Samantha, you missed the window. Doesn't negate anything that's happened to her. No. It doesn't take away the scramble of whatever her life has become, who she could have been. While she's trying to survive, while she's trying to heal, while she's just trying to make it through the pain and the agony of what's been done to her with no resources and no help because this happened within her family. And then the SBC, out of nowhere, comes as an entity, Lifeway, Southern, SBC, Executive Committee, comes in. Can you imagine how Samantha felt when her attorneys notified her of this amicus brief?
I can't.
She came from a Southern Baptist church. Samantha, at one time, you know, she had a background within the churches. I don't know anything about what her standing is now. I can imagine she's much like me and would have a hard time stepping foot in a church. But after what they've done to her, after what's been done to Jen Lyle, what's been, you know, done to Hannah Kate's case and story, it's crushing. And this morning, I had to go for a walk just to get some fresh air and get out from under so much of this because it's becoming a dark cloud. And on my walk, I chose reggae music for my walk today. I usually listen to a podcast or something. And for whatever reason, I wanted some sunshine. And it was interesting because some of the songs that played were so lifting. And I thought about the state of the church. I thought about the messages that we are supposed to be sharing the good news about. I thought about the fact that the SBC, through their legal teams, and SBC, I'm including Southern Lifeway, all the entities that took part in this. This was a defense move, acting out of fear of potential litigation to come and litigation that's already happening and litigation that's out there, knowing what I was telling you about evidence for survivors. And how that evidentiary evidence is already absolutely minuscule for us to be heard or seen, or for it to have any impact in our case. But it still bears that burden of proof. We still have to go through all the processes. Proverbs 29:25 says, "The fear of man lays a snare." And I think that's what this move was. It was a snare. It was a fear move to show and to help everyone to look right now at these entities, at the institution of this religious organization that we all have grown up in and been a part of. And that trap was laid, the snare was set and was taken by this move and all the others in the history of it. And now, what do you do with it? How do you fix it? Survivors chose the light. We chose to come out from under this darkness to say it's not holding bondage on us anymore. We're going to bring it to the light, and we want you to see so that it doesn't happen to somebody else, so it doesn't continue to happen in our churches. We already know how we're supposed to act. We know what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to act justly, love mercy, walk humbly. God is a God of hope and justice. And that's what the SBC and its leadership needs to be doing, not saying, but doing. And so, again, I kind of end with the question that we've all been asking, what will you do now? What will you do to fix this?
Well, I am hopeful, not hopeful, that's the wrong term. I am prayerful and committed to a future where the norm is for abusers to be held accountable, for institutions that protect them to be held accountable, and for survivors to find that they have advocates everywhere inside of those who say they represent Christ. And so to you both, Rachel and Tiffany, you know, thanks so much for being on, but also my prayers are with you. And then prayerfully, I'm hoping at some point my actions will be sufficiently with you as well. And so God bless you all for taking this time.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.